welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. We are recording on the afternoon of Friday, the 6th of March, 2015. We're headed towards the Ides of March. Who knows what that will be this year. Let's look, first of all, at the overall strategic situation. This probably starts with Ukraine, and it starts with the arrival now of U.S. military trainers who will be operating in western Ukraine, in the Lvov area, in the fascist stronghold, in the area where the nostalgia for the Nazi SS is strongest, in the area of Lvov, Lviv, Lemberg, whatever you like, Galicia. This is where the U.S. Trainers will be operating. And we have a statement quite categorical from the Russian Foreign Ministry, the spokesman of the Russian Foreign Ministry, Alexander Lukashevich, says, and I quote, U.S.-Ukrainian military drills in the western Ukrainian Lviv region threaten Russia's security. Security threatened. That is a very stern warning. You threaten Russia's security, this cannot end well. It is time for these neocon fascist madmen on the U.S. side to back down, to be fired. We have heard in the course of the week from the unspeakable Madame Nuland. Madame Nuland is an embarrassment to the United States and to the anti-fascist history of the United States. She is unpresentable. She is crude, scurrilous, ignorant, and boiling over with venom. She is a bubbling cauldron of hate and venom. And we cannot allow this, right? She's got to be fired. Fire Nuland, impeach Nuland, discredit Nuland. Anyway, this has to be done. Now, we've also had the exchange of compliments here. The Deputy Secretary General of NATO is an American, at least that's what they say, an American by the name of Alexander Vershbow, V-E-R-S-H-B-O-W, and he says that this is an angry and revisionist Russia. And he even goes on to say that the goal of the policies that Putin has put into place is to prevent a color revolution from bringing about regime change in Russia, which I believe is a perfectly legitimate goal. Why should you sit there and let the regime change be perpetrated against you? Certainly, people who read my book, Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, Spring 2008, will recall the the systematic attention given in that book to the question of the color revolution, the Brzezinski plan, the breakup of Russia. Vershbow essentially saying you're not allowed to stop regime change and stop our color revolutions. We've also got the Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov, and he says anybody in NATO who is making noises about a threat by Russia to Eastern Europe is, quote, mad and, quote, paranoid. So we've also got Lukashevich saying that the goal of these U.S. military trainers is how to use overseas, meaning U.S., British, military equipment. It is evident that they are not trying to bring peace to the country. Kiev authorities and all the Ukrainian people should think about the possible consequences of such steps. Lukashevich goes on to say, suppose the citizens of Donbas start being killed with the use of U.S. weapons. Where will that lead? This is a bankrupt policy. Lukashevich also points to the fact that it looks like we're getting the NATO warships coming into the Black Sea for Operation Sea Breeze. You'll remember last year, Sea Breeze was one of the things that it was associated with some of those aircraft coming down. Lukashevich says this time, speaking of the ships that entered the Black Sea, I would call it a very worrisome signal, a provocative idea that does not add to stability and confidence that the peace process will be stepped up. This is all reported in Sputnik. Sputnik has a very interesting proposition. This is a new service, right? I think it's filling the RIA Novosti niche. And these are now, I think, basically interchangeable. So a massive escalation of tensions between the great powers. I've been reading to you, the quotes come from the article, Russia denounces arrival of U.S. military trainers in Ukraine, Carol J. Williams, Los Angeles Times. So we've also got the internal Russian situation. The hysteria around the assassination of the oligarch and nomenklatura privatizer, the bandit capitalist, as he called himself, Boris Nemtsov, quickly canonized, made a saint by the Western media. And I believe I heard this morning a report that Alexei Navalny had been at least briefly detained, maybe longer, by the Moscow police as he was handing out leaflets in a in the Moscow subway, the metro. So all of this building up to a continuation of this crisis. Now, on the other side, we did have the founding, refounding, of the American Committee on East-West Accord. That took place this past Monday morning in Brussels, Belgium, in the Rue Froissart, right, the famous historian, in Froissart. This was a press conference attended by Professor Stephen Cohen, Emeritus Princeton, Emeritus NYU, Katrina Vandenheuvel, owner of The Nation, and Professor John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, the so-called realist. And I believe Professor Doktorow, or Doktorov, who has been writing for Russia Insider. And indeed, Doktorov appeared this week on Russia Today, RT, listed as a spokesman or member of the American Committee for East-West Accord. Two things to be said about this. First of all, we absolutely welcome the founding of the East-West Accord, the refounding, recreation of the American Committee for East-West Accord. You've seen that we've been calling for this on the broadcast here, on my website, tarpley.net. This is clear, but at the same time, we would have to say this was not really well publicized. In other words, this was very hard to find. So we're hoping that it gets more publicity. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So, escalation of superpower tensions, but now at least there is a vehicle to fight back. I urge all people of goodwill to join or support or otherwise spread the word that there is now this American Committee for East-West Accord and that there is at least some kind of organized activity to fight back against the neocon warmongers, but also against the humanitarian bombers. We know them, the Samantha Powers. They're every bit as vicious every bit as warmongerish are the humanitarian bombers compared to the neocons. So that's the way that looks, right? The hysteria around Nemtsov. Well, let's see where it goes. Now, we also want to take a look at the U.S. domestic front. Extremely worrisome things are going on. The first thing is the Wisconsin State Legislature is now in the process of voting for or enacting the so-called right-to-work law. That is a misnomer. It should not be repeated. It is called the union-busting law, or indeed the fascist anti-labor law, fascist anti-worker law. And you may ask, oh, what is this big, a hue and cry? Can't we say they're conservative? No, they're not. If you say that they're conservative, Governor Walker is a conservative, you're lying. So don't lie. Don't lull people into a false sense of security. Conservative is altogether too reassuring for a militant fascist. Walker is a fascist. If you don't call him a fascist, you're lying. You're not doing anybody a service. You are completely hiding the fact of what is going on. So it looks like they've voted for it, at least one house, and it's going to go to Walker. So within a few days, Wisconsin is going to fall into the ranks of the right-to-work states. And this is a trend in these places that have fallen under reactionary Republican rule. Now, just remember a couple of things. Without the fecklessness and the treachery and the corruption of the Democratic Party, this would never have occurred. We were reminded of that this week when the former Democratic governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, appeared to defend Hillary Clinton. She was a slavish, completely propitiating defender. Anything Hillary does, Granholm will defend. That means anything Wall Street does, Granholm will defend. This is absolutely unacceptable. So you can see what kinds of inadequacy and worse of the Democratic Party made possible the victory in Wisconsin. And also remember, Michigan is also now a right-to-work state. How horrendous! The homeland of the United Auto Workers, of the various sit-down strikes of 1936, and that's now a right-to-work state. And Indiana is also in this column, and there are others, right? Certainly, in Ohio, Governor Kasich tried very hard to go all the way there, but I think he was stopped by a referendum. So, we have a reactionary offensive. We can see that Walker is the recipient of the Koch backing, and that, of course, includes huge sums of money that we can assume are being paid in. And now we have to put that together with the fact that the United States Supreme Court has accepted this case on Obamacare. We are now headed towards a constitutional crisis of the first magnitude over the Supreme Court and this Obamacare case. The idea being that this obscure phrase established by the state, I guess it's the state with a small s, because you could imagine if it were the state with a large s, and even without the large s, there's nothing to be debated here. Based on this nominalistic, pedantic, textualist effort, they're going to try to bring down Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. Now, look, the original intent, they cannot argue in original intent, because original intent was that everybody would get to sign up. Either you'd get to sign up through your state, or if your state government was reactionary, you could go directly to a federal website that would be set up for your state. But that's not good enough for these nominalists. Now we get the textualists. And of course, Scalia, the biggest sociopath on the court, Antonin Scalia. I've been sending out some gems from Scalia's recent career on Webster G. Tarpley Twitter, which you should be following at least once a day, preferably more than once. Scalia is an originalist when it suits him, but in this case he doesn't want to do that because it would be clear he would lose. Then he becomes a textualist. He becomes an even bigger obscurantist. The suit was brought by the Competitive Enterprise Institute. This is in the orbit of Mellon and Richard Mellon Scaife, the late, but that's where the money came from, and now Koch. So this is another Koch offensive. Koch is attacking in Wisconsin. Bust all the unions with the help of the fascist governor. Go through the Supreme Court. Get the rats cabal mobilized. Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Scalia, and quite possibly the reactionary sort of weather vane Kennedy. They're all on the attack. Remember, Scalia was put in there under Nixon. He's a product of the corrupt, criminal Nixon White House. Then appointed by Reagan, the union buster. He is the biggest sociopath. And his Scalia's response today was, of yesterday or whenever these things were held on Thursday, he said, well, if you strike down the law, that might create chaos, of course, but Congress can easily fix it. Now, that is either the greatest cynic since Diogenes in the battle, or it's an advanced case of Alzheimer's, right? He just doesn't know what he's saying. So what has to happen? Impeachment. People have got to remember that the remedy for having these reactionary judges and worse is impeachment. Judges can be impeached. It used to be in the 50s and 60s that we had the impeach Earl Warren movement. That was a very common bumper sticker on the American road back in the 1960s. Well, of course, it was done by reactionaries. It was, in those days, it was done by racists and the John Birch Society, who didn't like the desegregation decision. But we are now reviving the notion of impeaching a Supreme Court justice. Impeach one to encourage the rest to cease and desist. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. It's the 6th of March, 2015. Now, concerning the question of the impeachment of Antonin Scalia, high crimes and misdemeanors, right? These judges can be impeached. Federal judge can be impeached just the same way a president or a secretary of state or a deputy assistant secretary. They can all be impeached. Impeached by the House, right? Majority vote, put on trial in the Senate. So what's the accusation? The accusation is, and the idea is, start the movement now. So if he does what he seems to be preparing to do, strike down Obamacare in this way, then you'll have your impeachment movement ready to go. But right now, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We're told by Linda Greenhouse of the New York Times that the left liberals, right, the progressives as she calls them, are defeatist in mood. Well, we're not defeatist in mood. We're in a fighting mood. And we say, impeach Scalia. Get ready. Now, others would say, well, why Scalia? Because he's the most hated. He's the most odious. He has compiled a track record of judicial barbarism that is quite frankly chilling. It's unbelievable that this has been allowed to go on. And again, you can thank the Democrats for not filibustering him when he came on the scene. This monstrosity that we've now got, right? A shame to the United States. So he's in there, and what they want to do is strike down the law. Now, if you strike down the law, you're going to throw the whole system into chaos. There are 7.5 million people who are getting these subsidies. And if you strike that down, most of them are going to lose them. In other words, they're getting these subsidies through the federal exchange, not through a state exchange. You're going to create chaos. You're going to create insolvency, bankruptcy, privation, people going without medical care. So the question is, how many will die? That's the relevant question. We already know that this court, the Roberts Court, is responsible for the 2012 decision. Roberts was not willing to go all the way to strike down Obamacare completely, but he partially crippled the law by saying you can, if you're a state, reactionary state, you can reject the Medicaid expansion, because that's your prerogative. So for no reason, you can simply say, I'm a reactionary Republican governor. I'm the governor of Virginia, whatever it is, or the state legislature. I will not expand, Medicaid. So they've already done it. Now we have this Harvard study, which again says that as a result of the failure to expand Medicaid to 36 states, about 17,000 Americans are dying or have already died. 17,000 deaths is more than Afghanistan and Iraq put together. It's true. Economics kills far more than war. Far more. So now, in addition to the 17,000 who are already dead or dying at this point, the Supreme Court is going to throw the entire system into chaos if Antonin Scalia and the Competitive Enterprise Institute have their way. Well, what is that? Manslaughter? Murder? Some would say that's murder on the Nuremberg scale. That the real question is, how do you get these people to Nuremberg? So remember, Supreme Court justices can and should be impeached if they, for example, carry out manslaughter against the American people. And remember who these people are. You can thank Scalia for the 2000 decision to stop the Florida vote count in the Bush v. Gore case. Remember that in that opinion that Scalia wrote at that time, he said, there is no right to vote in the United States. Are we dreaming? Is this delirium? Citizens United, let's have foreign donors control the U.S. Congress. And they do. I guarantee you, it's not just an Israeli party. We have that. But there's a Chinese party in there. There's a Japanese. There's a Brazilian, whatever you want. It's there, mainly Chinese, because they have the money. Hobby Lobby, right? If you're a plutocrat, your religious opinions come first, and forget the medical needs of the people working for you. So in the 1960s, it was the impeach Earl Warren bumper sticker. Well, let's think about how that would look with impeach Scalia, right? So 7.5 million. And in the first ranking, there's also this question that if you do this, you're going to put the entire Obamacare into a death spiral. So how many will die? I'm not a fan of Obamacare. I wanted and want Medicare for all, paid for by a Wall Street sales tax. But this is now what we have. This, for the relevant historical future, we're stuck with this. Think about the rats cabal today. In the 1930s, it was called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And they blocked all the New Deal legislation, right? Half a dozen decisions striking down New Deal legislation. So Roosevelt tried to pack the court. He didn't quite succeed in packing the court, but he scared the daylights out of those reactionaries so that they began to back off. And by the end of 1937, the Supreme Court had abandoned its systematic sabotage of everything that the New Deal was trying to do. There's also then the question, suppose everything goes bad. Lincoln had a problem with Chief Justice Roger Taney of Maryland. You'll remember him. Taney, written Taney, T-A-N-E-Y, and it's easy to get them mixed up, a copperhead, right, a Confederate, but he stayed behind. So he had written the Dred Scott decision that black people have no rights. So the Civil War starts. The Baltimore mob, urged on by secessionist agents, tries to cut the rail line between Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. Lincoln suspends habeas corpus and declares martial law because there's a rebellion going on. It couldn't be clearer. So Taney gets into the act with the famous decision, Ex parte Merriman, which says, Lincoln, you do not have the right to suspend the habeas corpus. Only the Congress can do that. So what did Lincoln do with that decision by Taney? He ignored it. Ignore it. Declare a state of emergency. Say tens of thousands of American lives are at stake now and then. And we're ignoring what these what the nine old men, right? That was Roosevelt's term, nine old men. Now we would say the rats cabal, right? Robert Zolito, Thomas Scalia, and, of course, Kennedy. You can't imagine that you're going to impeach all of them. That is simply not serious. Roberts would really be the guy to impeach if you wanted to make an impression and strike down somebody who otherwise will be on there for decades to come. Scalia, of course, has been on there for 30 years already, way too long. But you also got to think how hard this is going to be, how hard it's going to be. And the way you can do that is that Scalia, I think, is already widely hated. I think there's a pool of hatred against Scalia which can be tapped into, and that can take the form of pressure on Congress, specifically the House. Get that guy out of there. That's an obscenity. We don't have the right to vote. We don't have the right to see who's buying elections. Bush, and of course Bush means all the wars, including Iraq, and all those deaths. So we have had enough of this out of control reactionary court. And they are not conservatives. Some of them are reactionaries, and some of them go all the way to fascists. And we'll be looking into that. So, that's the current, situation. So this, what we can see from Wisconsin to, the Supreme Court, we've got this terrible, the situation. Now, let's just also look. Holder of the Justice Department has come out with a study of Ferguson. We say, after you've done Ferguson, go to Benton Harbor, Michigan. Go to Berrien County. That's where we need the Justice Department probing. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We've now, just wrapping up on the Supreme Court. We are now in a constitutional crisis, and we're also gonna, we've got another constitutional crisis coming up. The debt ceiling. Don't look now. The middle of March, the reactionaries, are going to try to get together and attack again on the debt ceiling and shut down the government that way. You will notice in the past week, Netanyahu came to town, a monstrosity. Then you've got, however, Boehner using that to tell his 50 to 60 person kamikaze caucus, the chuckleheads, the wacko birds, that they're going to have to give up on the attempt to shut down the government over Obama's decision to halt some extraditions. No, can't have that anymore. So the other problem was McConnell in the Senate was trying to get a bill through that would start imposing more economic sanctions on Iran right away. That was stopped. So the Republicans have been defeated on a number of things. I can imagine there is simmering rage in that kamikaze caucus of chuckleheads and wacko birds, and that they want to shut down the government. So we're headed towards another constitutional crisis. We got two. We got Obamacare in the Supreme Court, probably coming out in June. And then we've got the mid-March for the debt ceiling, right? Where we say the 14th Amendment, Obama, you're going to have to push ahead. So executive authority, the power of the federal state. Yeah, of the state. And when it says state, that doesn't necessarily mean these little individual states. It means that there's an overriding state interest in keeping the health care plan on track. So we got all of that going on. Now, the Tikrit offensive and the activities of our dear friend General Allen, the ISIS czar. This is now a huge scandal. Look, back in late January, January 22nd, from Tampa, we have dispatches saying the U.S. and Iraq have begun preparations for an assault by summer to retake Mosul, selecting and training military units and cutting supply lines to Islamic State militants who have been controlling Mosul. So it comes from General Lloyd Austin, the head of Central Command. He's still in his job. So he says, we're going to attack. Now, what does that mean? You're revealing your battle plan to ISIS. What does it mean further? It means that we have a pro-ISIS faction in the U.S. military. Let's get that clear. There are generals in the U.S. military who want to preserve ISIS for what? To use it against Syria, against Assad, against Iran, and ultimately in Chechnya against Putin. We've just had the absolute classic U.S. agent, Abdul Hakim Belhaj. He was known in early 2011 as Hassadi Belhaj. You can go back to Tarpley.net in August and even earlier of 2011. And there he is, Belhaj. He is now announced himself as being one of the top people in Libya, right? He's the Libyan branch of ISIS. So in Libya, you've now got on one side Hifter from the CIA. He's the anti-Islamic, and then Belhaj is the Islamic. So between them, they're going to make sure that Exxon and the rest of them, Chevron, get the oil out at the price they want onto the world market. So the overall situation then is, the people in Iraq, the Iraqi army, has seen that the U.S. Central Command tells their secrets to ISIS. So in the past couple of days, we had the beginning of the Tikrit offensive by the Iraqi army reconstituted and by Shiite militias. I think it's going to be the Mahdi army of the southern part of Iraq, right? The lower Euphrates. And Muqtada Sadr and the Mahdi army from south of Baghdad are now operating north of Baghdad, and they are attacking Tikrit with some success. And the main reason they're successful is they did not tell the U.S. They did not ask for any help. So they, after the fact that their plans were revealed to help ISIS, they don't trust the U.S. anymore. Now, on the NPR this morning, in the middle of an overwhelming warmonger consensus, unbelievable, really, National Public Radio, National Pentagon Radio, they were essentially saying, oh, but now we got to watch out for Shiite war crimes. Watch out for those Shiites. Now, this is, you know, I thought we agreed that that ISIS was the end of the world, which in some ways it is. But now they're pointing to that. So, the idea is that if you want to get anything going, you've got to keep it secret. Now, who could be doing this? All eyes turn to the ISIS czar, John Allen. Was it Allen who orchestrated that leak from the Central Command in Tampa? That nest from there, right? We have to see. This was the same Tampa where we had Petraeus and Paula Broadwell cavorting. And later we had, of course, General Allen himself and the socialite Jill Kelly, right? The Lebanese woman, very strange. So we're in an atmosphere of intrigue and secret suspicion. And here's the other one on General Allen. The Israelis and the PLO. We know that there has been in recent years this security cooperation agreement between the PLO and the Israeli government. This has now been terminated by the PLO side, by Abu Mazen. So the question is, how did that come about? And we were told on NPR this morning, General Allen, the ISIS czar, had been doing everything he could to prevent that breakdown of cooperation between the PLO and the Israeli government. Now, maybe it's just the opposite. Now, here we cannot do justice here today to the entire Netanyahu. I would refer you to my Twitter feed, Webster G. Tarpley. This was a parody of the State of the Union address. It contained a very clear threat, right, that if you U.S., do not take military action against Iran, I will drag you in. Listen to it. It's unmistakable. Parody of the State of the Union, glad-handing as he walks down the aisle. Elie Wiesel up in the balcony, that well-known demagogic technique. And the questions that we would have to ask, well, first of all, note, right, the big successes. Netanyahu succeeded in hiding the fact that Israel is armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, whether it's 500 or 1,000. They have a nuclear submarine on patrol at all times for essentially a second strike against anybody in the world. It's also the fact that it's not just the U.S. and Kerry that are negotiating with Iran. It's the Perm 5 plus 1. It's half the world. It's Russia, China, Britain, France, the United States, and Germany. It's half the world. And this is completely hidden in the coverage, right? Where Netanyahu portrays this as strictly a U.S.-Iranian deal. Question, one interesting question coming from a dissident on NPR today. Will Netanyahu now visit the other capitals? Will he go to Beijing, Moscow, Paris, London, and Berlin, and give the same speech in their parliament? Or how about it if Obama goes back and gives a speech in the Knesset against other variations of his name? So Netanyahu came as a harbinger of war. He is persona non grata. Fall back to U.S. ambassador. He will be back. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, and we're now extremely pleased to be able to go once again this week to Athens, Greece, and to talk to one of the most successful, distinguished observers of Greek and indeed European political and economic affairs, and that's Michael Tsiotinis. And we are very proud to have Michael with us, because if you go back and look at the events of the past couple of months, you will see that not only has Michael been an extraordinary reporter, but that he has got a gift for forecasting and looking ahead and actually predicting some of the things that would be happening. And I think his track record will stand up against anybody's, and that he's going to prove to be better. So again, very, very honored and proud to have him with us. And now, Let's see what Michael has to report this week. Michael.
Hello, Webster.
Greece is a little bit out of the news, but you help us to catch up.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the intro. What we're facing right now is the uncharted territory of a Greek default. Now, it's not exactly uncharted, because Greece has typically defaulted twice. During the last 3 years, the PSI, this haircut that was done in the beginning of 2012, was a typical default. It was a credit event anyway.
Michael, let me just ask you, because some people say, well, why do you need a second haircut when you had that haircut before? And my understanding with that is that haircut really didn't cut off very much hair.
This haircut that was done in 2012, it was part of the second bailout, and it had very big problems. The problems were that only debt to private holders was cut, and that included all the pension funds in Greece, all the money in account that have public institutions in bank accounts, like universities or hospitals. And they, before this haircut, much part of the debt, of the outstanding debt, was already transferred to public institutions, to the public sector, to the official sector. Bonds were bought by governments, and all this EFSF or these ESM, these institutions made up by the Europeans to bail out Greece. So these bonds were not haircut. only the bonds held by private institutions were haircut at that point, and it wasn't much of the Greek debt. It was a small part of the Greek debt that was haircut, about 50%. So,
and when you say these public institutions, that includes the European Central Bank, and then these other things, the European Stability Mechanism, I guess it is. In other words, European Union institutions. So they lost nothing, only the pension funds, the universities, the hospitals in Greece.
Yes, and it was the first. It was a default. The credit default swaps were triggered, but it was the first default and haircut that had as a result to the domestic holder of debt to be hit. Not the foreign creditor. Basically, what was hit was Greek domestic institutions. So we actually and Greek banks. So we actually did nothing. And then we borrowed more to recapitalize the banks that were haircut. So that was crazy. That was nothing. Really. Now.
Okay, and where are we now then?
Where are we now? Right now, we're facing an actual default. A default that is not going to be agreed upon, or not in the context of an agreement. And there's no legal issues, but bank runs and things like that can complicate things. Right now, let me tell you, Syriza, this government that we have, is obviously threatening to change the state of affairs in Europe. Okay, it's challenging the status quo. I think that the Europeans, and especially the Germans, are determined to make this government fall. The Eurogroup agreement of the 20th of February, this Eurogroup agreement that we had in the past, a few weeks ago, was a small crack in this unchallenged status quo. And I think they're trying to roll back this thing. They're trying either to make Syriza part of the system or make the government fall. And I think that's a very big danger. We have government revenue has collapsed during this the January and February. And we have, there's a very tough situation fiscally. The debt payments due inside March. Actually, the finance minister Varoufakis said that somehow we will squeeze some funds in order to repay the IMF, because no one has defaulted on the IMF before. But payments to the European Central Bank that has actually, the ECB has ownership of some bonds, many bonds that are due in the near future will not be made. Varoufakis says we will not pay back the ECB. The ECB should give an extension. It has happened before with Ireland, I think. But the problem is actually political. It's not economic. That's my view. The European institutions, this priesthood around Europe, along with the European Central Bank, they have to decide what is to be done. The big Euro powers like Germany. Germany is a country that pushes things towards this one-dimensional view of austerity, austerity, and more austerity. In my view, they are trying to get rid of the Syriza government, or you know, put it in the tracks of the previous government. But I think things are going towards a fall of the government. They're trying to make things to foment panic and make the government fall. And in my view, the problem is that they may think that in the eventuality of a collapse of the Syriza government, they can revive the old system, the conservatives and all these austerity vampires. Well, they can't. They will get centrifuge forces, and the euro will break up if they try to do this. And someone has, it's in the hands of Europeans and people in other countries to change the policy of their governments, because they will produce phenomena that have to be avoided.
So a general that would of course mean the beginning of another phase of a general breakdown crisis, right? Just somebody here in the U.S. Everybody's gloating that the business is over and full employment is back. Well, there's no full employment. So Germany, do we know exactly where this is coming from? Is it Merkel? Is it Schäuble? Is it this Deutsche Bank group around different, the Weidmann group in the Bundesbank? What would you say about that? Any idea?
Merkel, I think Merkel is an opportunist. She goes where the things go. So I think it's Schäuble controlled by,
And of course the British, right? This would be self-serving for the British and the U.S. All right, so that's a worrisome piece of news. So thank you, Michael, and we'll be back next week, okay?
Thank you.
You hang in there. See you soon. We'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Please go ahead, Reverend.
Hey, how you doing? Well, sir.
Fine. We can hear you. Go right ahead.
Yeah, great. I just want to tell you it's a pleasure to be on your show today. It's an honor.
And privilege.
And I'm very happy. And it appears that we're moving forward. I'm here at the prison complex here, and no one would believe what happened here in this prison system. But I tell you one thing, Webster, with your help, we're going to show them that we can do something and help these prisoners out. You got people here serving 50 years in prison. They have served already 50 years, and it's time that we do something about it. And, you know, even I'm here today, I'm a man here who's sitting here in prison with people who have already served 50, 40, 30 years, and I was convicted by a jury, which was a lynch mob, with absolutely no evidence at all. And I tell you something, Webster, I'm excited because now we get a chance to go to the appeal court and really do some real damage, show the world what we can do if we learn to work together. So, Webster, I'm happy today. Normally I'm here. I can help people here. We can get the word out about what's happening inside the prison system. And that's what people need to know, that there's some problems here. And, everybody here is not going to get out and kill your wife and children. You got some good people here who's in here and should not be in here. And I'm advocating for them, the people here inside this wall, people here inside this prison, because it's crucial that we get the word out. Because this is the only way that they're going to be able to get the word out by my help. So if
Reverend,
you have any questions.
I understand that little, we've got a small victory that you've won, which is no longer in Marquette up there in Siberia on the shore of Lake Superior, but you're in the Lakeland cold water facility. Can you just tell us about that?
That's right. You are absolutely correct. And listen, you heard how they talk about water. Now, our waterboard is torture, right? They got
right.
A new system in the prison system called travel boarding. Well, they bring you down here, take you 2 days to get here, and they have you all shackled up, and the bus driver refused to cut heat on to give you heat. And also, one other big thing that I want to talk about the food here. The food here is the worst there is in the world. I wouldn't even feed this food to a dog. But yet and still, they're feeding it to human beings. And health care is really off the chain also. So we got some work to do, Webster. We got to tell the world and let people know that there's problems here in this prison system, and they need to be exposed immediately. And the only way we can do it, we can let the world know, and by doing these radio shows, helping people out.
Absolutely, Reverend. Now, please tell us again, your next likely appearance has to do with the problem of a juror who committed, who told lies.
Perjury. He committed perjury.
Perjury.
That's what she did. She perjured herself by not telling the truth. She knew that she was she was friends with the county clerk and never mentioned it when we asked her about it at the trial. We asked her was she connected to them in any kind of way, and she was silent because she knew that she was connected to her. So we're going to, on the 14th, we're going to put her on the stand, and we're going to make her lie. That's what we're going to do. But we got her just where we want her, because nobody will believe what's happened. Also, she's with the sheriff department. She's a cheerperson for some kind of parade, and the sheriff had been in the parade for the last 13 years, and she never admitted that. So we got some major issues that we can deal with. So that's just really, really tremendous. Also, we're still trying to get our transcript. We're trying to get the transcript of that hearing that we had just on February 27th, and also we're trying to get the transcript of the trial itself. So we're doing some incredible things, some incredible work, and we want to make sure that we're doing the things that need to be done in order to make this thing a reality, not just for Reverend Pinckney. It's also for each and every person that's behind these bars, that's locked up, that's in jail, that shouldn't be in jail.
Okay, Reverend, so that means go to bhbanco.org and look, and you'll see that PayPal. The PayPal feature is there, and go and make a contribution.
Absolutely, and we need it as soon as possible in order to get this thing done. We need as soon as possible to get this thing done, because we need all the help we can get right now. We need people standing up, calling, doing the things that need to be done. And also, we're going to put out a poster about this judge. We're going to put his name, Warning for Crimes Against Humanity. And we're going to have his big picture there. And then we're going to also say that, you know, down at the bottom, how he has no integrity, he has no morals, and he's dishonest. And he's running a criminal enterprise with a lich mob jury. So those are the things that we're going to emphasize on the poster in reference to this judge. And also we're going to make one of the prosecutor also saying the same identical words, and we're going to get this juror, too, right before the trial. So we're doing some work. We're doing some things. We're making sure that we can do the things that need to be done. But we need everybody's help. We need you to spread the word. Get the word out there. Let them know what we're doing, and we need your help. Also, don't forget to go to bhbanco.org, PayPal. We need your help right now.
And there was this report from the Justice Department this week about Ferguson, Missouri, and that was very bad, of course. But a lot of people saw that, and they said, well, now, once you've done Ferguson, you better go to Berrien County, Michigan, Benton Harbor, and St. Joseph, Michigan, and the court of Sterling Schrock and Sheriff Paul Bailey and Prosecutor Mike Sepik that you mentioned, and let's get them under the investigatory spotlight, because there are things there that are just as bad as Ferguson.
You are absolutely correct, and it's been going on too long. It's really all across the country. It's not just of Ferguson, it's not just Benton Harbor. You could talk about Wayne County, talk about all the other places, but the point is, we have to come together and stand up and fight together. We cannot. It doesn't make a difference whether you're black, white, Mexican, Puerto Rican, Chinese. It don't make a difference. We have to stand together and fight this monster. We have to fight this criminal enterprise, and we can do it. And we're going to win at the end, because there's more of us than them.
We've also got this issue.
You have 1 minute remaining.
I only got 1 minute left. Webster, let me read.
Just your last comments, Reverend. You get the last word.
All right, bhbanco.org. bhbanco.org. Let's stop this criminal enterprise, this lynch mob mentality that they have. Let's stand together and fight together. Let's win this battle. We're fighting a war. The point is, there's a lot of people not participate. If you can't stand by my side, you can also help financially. Whatever needs to be done, you can do it. So let's stand together, fight this battle, and win. And let's say enough is enough so we can do the things that need to be done.
Reverend, you have the number to call in. We would love to have you here every week at this time. You have the number. Call us every week. We'll put you right on.
I will call in every week. That's a promise. I'll be in. Every week I'll be on your show.
Okay, wonderful. And again, congratulations. You're not quite in Siberia. You're a little closer to home, right? You can get some visitors.
That's right. Absolutely.
And you're loyal.
Thank you for using Global Telling.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C. Now, we've just heard from Reverend Edward Pinckney at the Lakeland Men's Correctional Facility in Coldwater, Michigan. That doesn't sound very good, but that's better than being up there in Siberia on the southern shore of Lake Superior with 36 below one evening not so long ago. But now we're going to go to two important guests, right? First of all, Daniela Walls, the chairwoman of the Tax Wall Street Party, and Gregory Edwards, who is covering for us the event going on in Washington, D.C., the Conference of the American Federation of Labor Congress of Industrial Organizations, the ALCIO. So let's have Daniela come on and set the stage, and then we'll go to Greg at the AFL-CIO.
Good afternoon, Webster. At this moment, the Tax Wall Street Party is on the ground intervening here at the AFL-CIO. Gregory Edwards, our trade union leader, party member, is at this exclusive AFL-CIO conference in D.C., and he is realizing that it's going to take the Tax Wall Street Party to lead these unions out of the woods. Greg is the guy who exposed Iglesias in New York, and he is now on the ground in Washington. I think we should turn to Gregory. Gregory.
Absolutely. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Daniela. Thank you. I am here at the AFL-CIO 25th Anniversary Organizers Institute. We are here at the Capitol Hilton in Washington, D.C., and the big theme here is to dream big. This is a term, unfortunately, we know too much about. This is a similar theme from the Iglesias event. Lots of dreams, not
sueños.
Too many demands.
Sueños.
Much sueños, not too much demand, though. There was a keynote address by Richard Trumka, the president of AFL-CIO. He focused on the fact that the country was moving in a left direction. He wanted to increase the minimum wage to $15. 12 million immigrants he wanted to legalize, but did not mention the connection of bringing them into the unions and that we're going to need these people for 30 million jobs in the United States. They focused their economics on what they call common sense economics. They were very vague on what this actually is. I did some quick research. It's by a Dr. Jacob Hacker, I believe from Princeton, and he calls it prosperity economics. It's very similar to what the United Front Against Austerity is pushing and what we believe in. But it does not have a system to develop the funds needed. It focuses on infrastructure, but does not talk about nationalizing the Fed. 1% tax on Wall Street. This is not mentioned at all. So we're getting a lot of dreams, not too many demands. We did break up into groups.
The AFL-CIO, on paper, they support a Wall Street sales tax, even though it's very small. So if I get it right, they're saying they want infrastructure, but they're not telling us who pays. That Wall Street has
Correct.
To pay and the Federal Reserve has to pay.
Correct. And the general tone of the people that are at this event are a lot of people that are just starting out here. They're trying to understand how to get organized. This would have been a good opportunity to explain in depth some of these policies of how they were going to achieve, you know, common sense economics, what the point of legalizing the 12 million immigrants is. And these are things that the Tax Wall Street Party and the United Front Against Austerity are talking about. And we have a plan for this. So a lot of people here, we were broke up into the groups, and we went into discussion sessions, and I took the time to inject our points, our call for a 15% protective tariff,
great,
30 million jobs, infrastructure investment, science drivers, and a lot of people were they were more focused on the fact that they did some great union organizing, but they could not really relate to how like a protective tariff helps the American worker and why this is so important for them to be pushing for.
They need to get educated.
It's,
we need to provide
yes.
that education and leadership.
Yeah, and the AFL-CIO was not taking the opportunity to do this, and they seem to kind of want to just have the upper echelon in this group handle that part of it and just let the rank and file take them out off into the woods and leave them somewhere, and then that's it.
But look, we just had today another big step. The Wisconsin legislature has at least partially passed the union busting law, the so-called right to work, in reality fascist union busting. Is there a fighting mood? Because this is the thing. The AFL-CIO has to see you can't use traditional trade union methods against an onslaught like the Koch brothers and Governor Walker, right? You're going to have to do something more. You're going to have to go for a mass strike. Do they understand it?
Amid the people that I spoke to and the discussions that were going through in this convention, that they do not, and that the problem they are having is that they didn't even mention Scott Walker. I mean, to have this event and not even mention Right to Work.
Unbelievable.
And
Unbelievable.
They actually highlighted
Field now beating back these reactionaries, and we're beating back Walker and the Union Busters. So they didn't even bring it up. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, they're doing a very poor job of conveying to the constituents what Right to Work is. A lot of them didn't know. I was explaining to them how this works and why this is bad for them. Also, Richard Trumka highlighted that things are getting better. There was a tone of we are having all these successes. And amid the recent news you just gave us, Webster, about how another state going into Right to Work possibly, this is certainly not getting better.
So they're not planning a counterattack, a counter campaign the way we are?
No, absolutely not. They do not have the organization to attack those kind of plans. There's a lot of platitudes being talked about, thrown around, but the actual meat and potatoes that you need to do to get these kind of things done is not being mentioned. Also, there's been a big focus
on... I'm wondering, you know, when you come in there with that 15% protective tariff, you'd think that that would be viewed as a godsend, right, for the to block the runaway shop and all the rest of it. But they don't have any... any protectionist demands, do they?
They don't. And it was difficult to get this across because the people had such a basic knowledge of how this could help them. I spent half the time explaining to them what this does for them as far as stopping the runaway shop and ending the free trade and how this was connected to the Confederate States. And, I would need another hour to get to them to explain to them why they need a 15% protective tariff. This is things that the AFL-CIO should be making number one priority.
And Greg, just to get it straight, you actually gave a workshop, am I right?
Not yet, but
no.
Not yet, Webster. That comes in the next couple days.
Okay,
yeah, we're looking for that. Hopefully tomorrow.
Okay, but any ability to get some reality injected in there is going to be vital.
That is the one positive. One of the one positive here is that it's called an unconference, and we can hopefully get our own workshop going before the end of the event.
And this is why we need more people to join the Tax Wall Street Party, because we're leading. Yeah, I mean,
motivate that, Daniela? Go ahead.
Well, you and I, Webster, are putting out this morning brief every morning now, 1 to 2 page brief, and for Tax Wall Street Party dues paying members. So if you want to have it, then start helping the party grow by paying $20 a month. You can do this at taxwallstreetparty.org. In the top right corner, there's a button that says PayPal. Hit the PayPal button and enter $20. Then before you press send, there's an option that will say recurring monthly. If you want to be a party member, then also write to me at taxwallstreetparty@gmail.com. And in the subject line, in all caps, write, I want to join, and include your phone number. We want to recruit Tax Wall Street Party members. We are now in almost every state and in 10 countries. If you are in another country, don't hold back. This is not U.S. only. If anything, it's the reverse of U.S. only. We are extremely interested in expanding into other countries. Tell us where on this earth you are. If you can hear us, contact us. We are about to launch a new website and completely rebrand to accommodate this epic expansion. Enrollment is exploding. The new website will have a global interactive map with dots to show where we are located. Each dot you can scroll over is going to have an operations report. You'll get to hear things like Fred Swing.
Okay, the hard break is coming. Thank you very much. Thanks to Greg Edwards covering the AFL-CIO Organizing Institute and Daniela Walls, known to our listeners as the chairwoman of the Tax Wall Street Party. Thank you both very much, and we'll see you next week, I'm sure. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now, what you just heard and what you've been hearing here week after week, the growth of the Tax Wall Street Party and the United Front Against Austerity, this should, I think, indicate that, for example, Paul Craig Roberts speaking to the Russian Academy of Sciences on February 28th, 2015, is too pessimistic and indeed not giving a clear picture to the Russian distinguished audience at the Academy of Sciences when he says that the internal U.S. political perspective is hopeless. He says the message is that the constellation of forces, meaning in the U.S., precludes internal political change. Well, that remains to be seen. And I told Paul Craig Roberts in 2007, when he was essentially prophesying inevitable war with Iran, I said, wait a minute, there may be countervailing institutional forces inside the United States. And between 06 and 07, maybe this was more in 06 that I had this exchange with him, you can see that there were countervailing forces, and the Republicans losing both houses of Congress and so forth, all of that is something that you have to factor in. So that's one thing. Now, one other interesting domestic or international item. Noam Chomsky, our dear friend Gnome. Gnome was cavorting with his dear friend Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! And essentially, Gnome was talking about the situation with ISIS in Iraq. Syria, he talks about less. He doesn't seem to recognize it. But Gnome comes out and says, and I quote, ISIS, quote, ISIS represents, quote, the legitimate demands of the Sunni population, which is what ISIS is protecting and defending and gaining their support from. I don't know what the headline for that would be. Gnome joins ISIS? I don't know. Gnome says Shiites are worse than ISIS? And, of course, Chomsky says no conspiracy theories that the U.S. is supporting ISIS. I feel like I'm personally involved there. Conspiracy theories that the U.S. is supporting ISIS, I guess that would be me, not as a conspiracy, but just empirical fact. How about empirical fact? Also, Gnome seems to think that Jihad John of Britain, he's like the guy in West Side Story, right? He's depraved on account of he's deprived. In other words, the poor guy, he was mistreated. He was beaten up, he was humiliated, he was harassed, and therefore he starts decapitating people. That's another one. Also, Gnome, again, seems to have a great dislike of the Mahdi army and Muqtada Sadr. Those are the bad guys for Gnome. So, This is a very, very distorted view of what's going on in the world. So the Gnome fans, please, you have to revise your situation. Now, we've also got the Hillary emails. How about this? Petraeus has now been forced to plead guilty to a misdemeanor for having classified information and in his black books and giving it to his paramour, Broadwell. Deutsch of the CIA was given a really hard time because he had secret documents in his laptop, home computer, whatever it was. Sandy Berger put documents in his pants and got a very hard time out of that. With Hillary, I think what we've got here is this reinforces the tremendous vulnerability, the tremendous instability of the Hillary candidacy. She's a Wall Street puppet. She's a warmonger, a neocon, always the biggest warmonger in the room because of her weakness on what she thinks is the woman question, which she thinks is a question. And then the secrecy, right? If you're a Democratic Party leftist and you're anti-NSA and you don't like snooping and you don't like this stuff, this obsessive secrecy, I think, is going to be a big problem. She says she's given in 55,000 emails, but there are still tens of thousands of other emails. So what is she going to decide? And remember, we don't need emails to condemn Hillary Clinton. All you have to do is watch that 15 or 20 second video where she says, "We came, we saw, he died," meaning Gaddafi was assassinated, and then dissolving in cackles. That ought to be enough to rule her out in the Democratic primary. Speaking of this, here in Maryland, We now have a big political earthquake going on. Senator Barbara Mikulski is quitting the Senate after 26, 28 years. She, of course, pioneering feminist in the Senate. Otherwise, the hopes have remained greater than the reality. But now we're going to have a Senate campaign in Maryland. We're going to have a House campaign in Maryland. And we'll have other campaigns as everybody tries to move up a notch. Even reports of people leaving the district to come over to the Maryland side. So we would have to say that the Tax Wall Street Party is studying the Maryland situation very carefully. Stay tuned. We'll have news about this in the coming time. Venezuela has cut the staff of the U.S. Embassy, and well, they might. If you don't want to have a color revolution, you better PNG a bunch of these people. And I think I mentioned the questions for Netanyahu were, is he going to give a speech in the parliament of every one of the Perm 5 plus 1? Now he's done the U.S. He would have five more stops. Apparently not. Is Obama going to go and give a rebuttal in front of the Knesset? Certainly an insult to the United States institutions that Netanyahu has carried out. And, of course, the worst thing about Netanyahu is he has essentially two positions. First one, he says, is what he wants is that Iran be kept prevented from having the capability to build a nuclear weapon. Now, the capability is widespread, right? Japan, Italy, Germany, lots and lots of countries, Brazil, South Africa, on and on, right? Indonesia. Lots of people have the capability. If you say, I don't want you to have the capability, it's a way of saying, I demand that you remain underdeveloped, backward, third world country forever. Who's going to accept that? And the other side of it is, well, if I can't have that, I want the U.S. at war. Sorry, the American people are sick of wars, especially Middle East wars. The other interesting thing, I don't have time to go through it all, if you go to my Twitter feed, you're going to find a compendium of all the times that Netanyahu has made these sweeping predictions. It was in 2009 that he told the delegation, the Iranians will have an atomic bomb within 1 to 2 years. Well, that would have been 2011 or 2012 at the most, but no. He has been making these predictions, crying wolf, building up hysteria and fear. Netanyahu has been doing that since the 1980s and the 1990s. I can remember seeing him on Ted Koppel's Nightline in the mid-80s already predicting the apocalypse. He is a discredited fearmonger. That's all he is. And we're hoping for Lapid. We're hoping for the lapidation of Netanyahu. No fourth term. And then we have the Herzog Livni combination. Just about anything would be better to break the hold of this sociopathic individual. We're told that there's full employment in the U.S. 5.5 is not full employment. We'll talk about full employment more in the coming weeks. So we'll see you soon on World Crisis Radio. Good night.